Joining me on Beyond the Playlist is Jay Schellen. He is a drummer and musician. Jay, how you doing?
Great, Hammond. Very well. Thank you for having me on.
I cannot express to you the level of excitement that I have of having you as a guest.
Well, thanks. Thanks much. I hope I live up to it.
Well, just when I started, when I realized you had done some work, been working with Yes, of course that got me excited because Yes is one of those legendary bands. It's been part of my listening life off and on through all of my life. And
yeah,
then,
one of my favorites too, for sure.
And then as I started doing a little bit more research, I realized that there's been crossovers of me listening to you off and on through, you know, early college and then, you know, into adult when I was discovering more proggy stuff and back and forth across the ways. So I've kind of always known about you, but not really known about you. So I'm really excited to have this.
Yeah, I've done a lot of work with a lot of different artists, producers, all across the board, from metal to melodic rock to fusion. And then, of course, progressive rock is really where my heart is. So, you know, I can't be any happier than where I'm at now, working alongside Alan.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yes, I know. It's incredible. It's fantastic.
So just before we get into everything else, though, would the 10-year-old you believe that you would be working with Yes at this point?
Well, let's say the 10-year-old in me was visualizing it. It was my daily routine, so to speak. Because I started playing probably when I was about 6 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I got to, you know, 10, 11, it was more like 13. I was visualizing myself playing Topographic Oceans.
Oh, wow.
And I would go into my den after school, and I had a little record player behind my drums and some headphones. And I would say to myself, hey, Alan needs some assistance. Does anybody out there know, you know, Ritual? Topographic Oceans. And I'd raise my hand and say, I do. And then I'd put the needle on the record and then I would play. So I would do this often, very often, you know. So I think if I had any look into a crystal ball and the band that I wish would have come to fruition, it was Yes, from a very early age. So I would say, I'm very happy about it coming to fruition, but it almost feels like it's been my focus since I was about 13.
So it's funny you put it that way, because it kind of goes into one of the beliefs that I have, is that there are going to be times in your life where opportunity comes knocking. But if you haven't put the work in behind the door before opportunity shows up, when opportunity does knock and you open the door, if you're not ready, all it's going to do is point and laugh and move on down the street.
That's right. Yeah. They say, you know, when people say, God, I'm so lucky, you know, actually, I feel the same way. Luck is basically a combination of being well prepared and seizing the opportunity.
Yeah.
But being prepared is the key. Definitely.
Especially when you're dealing in a musical instrument, but especially when you're dealing in prog, because you can't fake prog drumming.
Right.
The math you're doing in your head nightly is more complicated than I'll do in 2 years ever.
Yeah, it's true. There's a lot of math, you know. I mean, I'm the product of a astrophysicist and nuclear engineer father and a mathematician for a mother. So maybe some of that comes a little easier to me, you know. And my dad was a musician as well, and he always said, look, you've got to learn the language. You have to know your theory and learn musical language so you can communicate with other players. So piano was my first instrument. So I got based, you know, early on in melody, rhythm, and theory from the piano. it's like a perfect instrument to start on. Mm-hmm. And then from there, of course, drums got my attention.
One of my friends here in town has played drums his entire life, and he played and sang with one of the bands that walk around on Main Street at Disneyland. And he told me that when he takes a drum student, if they don't have at least a year of piano under their belt before they come in, he will kick them to a piano for a year and then have them come back to drums. He said, because the foundation you get with piano is irreplaceable and so important moving forward into drums.
Wow. That I agree with totally. What a cool concept. That's great.
Well, because not only does it teach you the foundations of melody, rhythm, harmony, even some of the in theory, but it also starts you on that limb independence that you're going to need as a drummer.
Yeah, to a certain degree. Yeah, you're kind of using, you know, you've got some pedal action going on, and it's kind of splitting your brain activity and getting a bit of hand independence. But then once you get into drumming, it is full body limb independence, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Which I was very fortunate early on when I was working at Lucchetti Drum and Guitar Shop in Albuquerque, which is where I'm from. I would set up drum clinics for all the drummers coming in because it was the premier drum and guitar store in Albuquerque. And as just a little nod, I guess, from each artist, they would give me a lesson. And I learned early on from Alan Dawson, who was a teacher, jazz drummer, amazing player at Berkeley. And I was really fascinated with his left foot technique. And so, of course, I asked him about it. So that's what our lesson was based on. And it's just a timekeeping technique with your left foot that allows you to have a quarter note or eighth note, whatever you choose, pulse that runs throughout your performance. So if you have everything tied to that, you have kind of your own built-in metronome, so to speak, that doesn't move with adrenaline, dynamics. It really just is a calming and a grounding, solid seat core thing. So I was really fortunate to learn that when I was about 15.
That sounds
and less, that's kind of been the foundation, yeah.
That sounds less musical and more disciplined at that point, because that's keeping you in a very centered, very aware place, kind of a mindfulness that you wouldn't expect that you'd need to be as a drummer.
Yeah, I guess my approach, you're right. It's a technical technique, but it does so much. So with my students, I have a book that's published on this as well, giving a big nod to Alan Dawson. It's his baby, so to speak. But what it does is, what I've always kind of gone for is a calmness amongst the violence, you know, because drumming is semi, you know, it's a violent kind of instrument. Mm-hmm. You know, you're really pounding on stuff. Things are loud. You know, you're putting so much energy into it. And then you have to be able to come back dynamically and, you know, cover all those different musical, you know, sounds. And I call it the rocking motion. Mm-hmm. But this technique allows you to just be very calm amongst all of this chaos. So I like to be almost yawning before I go on stage instead of hyped up. You know, I know a lot of drummers, especially back in the day, you know, doing a Hurricane and, you know, stuff like that. But a lot of drummers would be very hyper and they would love to get jazzed, you know, before they took the stage. I was always the opposite. I was always just trying to stay calm and loose.
Well, I think that provides itself to a middle ground where that you can have that slower tempo and be more in control, because, you know, the tendency is when you're hyped up for your tempo to increase and for you to play faster. which changes right. the whole sound of a song in some cases. I mean, if you're not playing the click track, you have to be aware of your inner time clock. And if you get too hyped up, your clock just naturally starts moving faster, which means everything around you moves faster.
Yeah, exactly. Because the other musicians are counting on just the solidity of the drummer. Mm-hmm. So when they can feel this very solid pulse, you know, and a groove, they will tend to relax as well. Mm-hmm. And it helps pull everything together.
It also helps establish that trust in a band, because it's not just you by yourself. It is you with, you know, 5 to 7 other people counting on you to be mm-hmm. the keystone.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, most modern production is using click tracks and things like that, which I do a lot of in live production as well with other things that I've been doing, like Rock Vault, raiding the Rock Vault in Vegas mm-hmm. for the last, it's going on 6 years. And that I was really excited when we first got together. You know, I got the call from Billy, and I had 3 days to prepare to leave. And then we had about 5-6 days of rehearsal for the topographic drama tour. Mm-hmm. And what I was excited about is that there's no click tracks, there's no augmentation whatsoever. It really is the musicians listening to each other and putting all this complex music together and then performing it. So it's a living kind of performance, which is very different than when you're on a click or a sequence. That can be a replicated performance practically every single night mm-hmm. in the same exact spirit mm-hmm. and tempos, obviously.
And I guess they both serve a purpose. I mean, when you're doing it more organically, doing it organically, it's a different audience experience, is a different experience for the band. And when you're doing with a click track or with a sequence, it has to be a little bit, I don't know, easier might not be the right word for it, but it's less mentally taxing. So you don't get as worn out night after night if you're doing it consistently. So it serves purposes.
Oh, of course. No, I mean, I don't really have a preference. I love each style, but you're exactly right. That's what it does, is it gives you your consistent place in time every night. Mm-hmm. So that is a great thing. It's very nice. But you are also exactly right when you talked about it's a different audience experience when you're not clicking every night, because there really is, you know, those nights when the band, somehow everybody is in this certain mental state that it comes together in a way that is magic, mm-hmm. you know, complete magic, synchronicity. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's exciting. Very exciting.
Well, we covered a little bit about your past, but I just wanted to know, what was the name of your first band?
Ritual.
What kind of music did you guys do?
It was, the hits of the day, you know,
which were
everything from Aerosmith, ZZ Top, Kiss, Rush, Pat Travers, just right in there. I mean, we even did some Cars. We did some Police. We did Zeppelin, all that kind of thing. But we were writing original music, mm-hmm. which, funny enough, I was the lyricist and co-writer, and it was pretty progressive, actually.
Well, I was going to say, I was thinking about everything on the spectrum. You've got ZZ Top to Kiss, and then across the river, you've got, you know, Rush and Zeppelin. So you really are playing on all sides of the spectrum.
Oh, yeah. Do you remember a band called Armageddon?
I do, vaguely, yes.
Yeah, yes, right, with Bobby Caldwell and some of the guys from Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
So we even did some of that stuff. So we were branching out into some, just the things we loved, as well as, you know, given, you know, the audience, the hits and stuff. And we toured. When I left home when I was about 19, and we hit the road.
Wow.
Yeah, doing that.
Well, as I was doing research, I realized that you were part of one of the bands that I consider one of my guilty pleasures from the late 80s, and that's Hurricane. And I'm more and more owning the fact that I like them, especially the first couple of albums. They're a lot of fun, and some of the songs just really stick to you, and I really love them. So I appreciate the fact that you were part of that.
Yeah, you know, it was a great time, and the band had some really unique members. Kelly Hansen, great singer, based a lot of his style in R&B and gospel, and just had a great tenor voice. He's singing, of course, now with Foreigner, mm-hmm. for the last probably 15 years. And just killing that gig. It's just, it's perfect for him. And then there was Robert Sarzo, who is a great guitarist that had, a Cuban influence, which is really something different and nice.
Mm-hmm.
And, then Tony Cavasso was a very straight ahead, fat, like Jack Bruce bass player.
Mm-hmm.
And so it definitely gave us, you know, a different kind of vibe. Plus we worked with some great producers, like Bob Ezrin,
mm-hmm.
Kevin Beamish, Michael James Jackson, and Mike Klink. So they were, especially Bob Ezrin, was very, just supportive of us stepping out of the 80s formula.
Mm-hmm.
And the second record really shows that. There's some very interesting tunes mm-hmm. on that one. Definitely.
It's funny. I mean, I'm On to You Got the Radio Play, but there are other albums or other songs on that album that I've gone back and rediscovered, and they're far more, they're not exactly radio friendly, but there's some prog elements and there's some unique things that happen in there that 1988 radio wasn't going to handle. But coming back and listening to it with more mature ears and more of a familiarity of what music is and what it's supposed to be and all that kind of stuff, there are some great songs on those albums.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that. Thank you. You know, we were just enjoying ourselves and working with some great people and just, you know, doing what we do. And I'm really happy with a lot of the stuff that came out, and mostly for exactly what you're describing. It didn't fit, you know, the formula, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So it did have a uniqueness to it, you know.
Mm-hmm. It did.
But we did suffer from record labels that were unstable and kind of new, yeah. So to speak.
What also seemed a little bit like they might not have known exactly what to do with you guys, because you sounded on the surface like what you were supposed to, but just below the surface, you didn't fit any kind of grouping that they could stick you with.
Well, that ended up working for us very well, because we ended up opening for a diverse number of groups, from mm-hmm. Cheap Trick to Iron Maiden to Gary Moore, Stryper, and a lot. So it was all working very well. And then we had our hits on all three records,
mm-hmm.
but particularly the last two, and we were getting ready to go out with Extreme.
Another band that was proggy in nature, but wasn't considered it in many ways.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it was fine. Everything was fine. And you're right. It may have taken, I think Slave to the Thrill actually had some songs that could have easily have broken into the big market, especially some ballads
mm-hmm.
and a couple of unique tunes. But the infrastructure supporting us was falling apart
mm-hmm.
at the same time. So basically we were set to go, but you know, the road crumbled underneath us, so to speak.
Yeah.
And at that point there was other opportunities and stuff, and we stayed together for a little while to work on it. But at that point, that's when I joined Unruly Child.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Another great melodic band.
You've played on a lot of tribute albums. How do you get lined up to be part of though that kind of all-star cast to do, you know, the Queen tribute, the Kiss tribute,
the
Jeff Beck, and you know, these ones that you've done? How do you kind of position yourself that you're one of the go-to guys for them?
I have a great tennis serve. I can play tennis really well. And really, that is the truth, because I was in a band, Stone Fury, as well, with Bruce Gowdy. And that was early 82. I mean, if we wanted to go over the kind of chronological thing, you know, 81, I was in Badfinger with Tony Kaye and Tommy Evans and Joey Molland and Glenn Sherba, who's the guy who invited me to Los Angeles in 81. So I was doing that, and I was getting a lot of notice at the Central, where I was playing with Peter Banks every week. Mm-hmm. Another Yes alumni, God bless him, that's his soul. And so I was getting a lot of action going on. So all kinds of different things were popping up, and that would take me into all kinds of different musical projects and things. So Stone Fury was one of them. And Bruce introduced me to Billy. He said, hey, you know, my buddy in World Trade, you got to meet him. And because he plays tennis too, because Tony and I were big tennis players. Mm-hmm. And then Billy and I got together. We played some tennis. And then he played me some tracks that were from an unfinished World Trade record. And we cut In Your Mind, that track, after playing tennis. And that began that connection. And soon after releasing that record, Billy and his business manager and a record label, I'm not sure which one it was at the time, it might have been Cleopatra, but I'm not sure. They came up with the idea of these tribute records. I don't really know how many tribute records were out at that time. So it was really way at the beginning of all of that. And so Billy was a producer, and I would play on a lot of things. And it, that probably ran a good 9 years.
Yeah, I was going to say the late 90s, early 2000s was a hotbed for those kind of tribute all-star albums.
Yeah.
I had everything from Working Man to the Queen one that you worked on, Dragon Attack. I had all of them because I loved the individual players. And in many cases, I was following the players from album to album instead of like, oh, I'm a big fan of Queen, which I was, but that wasn't the primary reason for me getting it. It was, oh my gosh, here are these five people who I like, and three of them are playing together. Oh my gosh, I have to get this.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the concept, and it worked very well. And the first one that we did was the Stevie Ray Vaughan tribute, mm-hmm. which I was thrilled about getting into, you know, a Texas swing shuffle thing. And we got to play with Steve Jordan. Trevor Rabin did a track, Phil Collin, and also let's just everybody. Mm-hmm. Everybody was on that. So I got a taste of it, and it did really well. And then I think we went to Jeff Beck after that. And so, you know, Steve Morse joined in. Everybody, you know, mm-hmm. all these great people were just really enjoying doing it. And it just kept going from there. And then eventually Bob Kulick, when Billy joined Yes, Bob Kulick kind of took over as the producer. And I was still going in and cutting a lot of stuff, you know, along with Tommy Aldridge and Carmine mm-hmm. and, you know, all these guys. It was great.
One of the things that I'm picking up as we talk is that the group of the community of musicians that you know and that you kind of interact with is a pretty good group. They help each other out. They're still play tennis with each other. I mean, it seems to be as social as you could be for a group of people who are on the road all the time. And it seems very supportive.
Yeah, it's kind of that community of, you may not see somebody for, you know, years actually, but when you do see them again, all the great memories come back and it's like, you know, you've never left, you know, it's a warm, friendly community of like-minded and just, you know, good spirited people. And that's one reason, I guess, you know, we enjoy the NAMM show so much, is it gives us an opportunity every year to kind of socialize.
Oh yeah. It's like a high school reunion.
It's like our friends.
Yeah. It's like a high school reunion except with drumsticks.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's true.
And
it's loud.
And a whole bunch of new gear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Too much. It's almost too much to take in. Yeah.
Well, I know as a drummer, the technology still changes and grows and morphs as technology continues to affect music. How do you work with that? Are you like a big technology guy and you're always trying out new stuff, or are you kind of, I've got my thing, I do my thing, leave me alone?
I'd say I'm kind of right in the middle there, because as I mentioned, you know, I'm a product of a scientist and a mathematician and an engineer. So, I mean, since the very young age, I've, you know, was taught to, you could, what one man can do, another can do by reverse engineering. Mm-hmm. So as I was even setting up these clinics many, many years ago, one of the guys was Carmine. You mentioned him. We've known each other since I was 15. And Billy Cobham, Michael Walden, all these guys. I was Louis Belson, Buddy Rich. I was so fortunate. But anyway, I digress. So I was always kind of mechanically analyzing things. So when it came time to put together my sets, I mean, that was the other thing I think I was known for at the beginning, is these over the top cage drum setups. Mm-hmm. Four bass drums, two flown, you know, just all that kind of crazy stuff, which was a lot of fun engineering wise, you know, to put that together. So the byproduct of all that, especially with Hurricane, is I was coming up with my own inventions and things. And so I would meet with the companies at NAMM and we would talk about certain things, and many of them came to fruition. And those companies, of course, I have been with for 30, 35 years. So in that sense, I am very happy with companies that I've been with: Zildjian, Remo, Drum Workshop, AKG, Vic Firth now for several years. So I do kind of stick. I don't move around, because I think I found the best companies that are always innovating and coming up with great products. And they also have an open ear to suggestion and stuff. So the relationship is perfect. So in that regard, yeah, I don't, you know, change very, you know, much. But I also have a drum studio. So that takes you into a whole other technical aspect, because I do the engineering myself and record drum tracks for producers all over the world. So that's a whole other thing. Mm-hmm. And that's extremely technical and can really make my brain hot, especially if you have computer hell one day, you know, and you got to deliver a track. Oh, my, crazy, you know, so you start to realize that a little too much of the technical side can actually pull you away from the emotional focus of the music you're trying to create. So I keep it simple. Mm-hmm. I always try to keep it very simple. If it's working, I don't try to fix it.
Yeah.
You know, and I try not to update. You know what I mean?
You're not,
I can't keep up with the Joneses, man.
Yeah, you're not bleeding edge technology, but you're technological.
Yeah, it's solid. It's HD. It at one time was the pinnacle, and that wasn't that many years ago. So I'm happy with that.
I remember
same way I like classic cars.
I remember when I was in college in the early 90s, I was playing in a bar band. And I was playing harmonica, and I was helping pay for college by playing harmonica. And I wanted to have a recording of my stuff, and so I could go back and hear what I did and learn from it, and just kind of a almost like a diary of my shows. And I went out and I bought a Tascam DA-P1, one of those portable DAT players that was encased in rubber. The thing was bulletproof and beer-proof and totally durable. And I had that thing, and I loved that thing until the early 2000s, because it was such a durable, reliable piece of equipment. But when I bought it, it was the absolute best of the best of recording digital technology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, it changes so quickly. And then throw in the middle of all of that, what you're describing, broadband.
Mm-hmm.
that changed everything for the music industry. Some of it in a very positive way that we're getting a hold of it now, but also in a very negative way of protecting our product.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Everything changed. And I feel so fortunate that I was in the business and doing, worldwide record sales and touring when it wasn't that technology.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to experience the way it used to work, which was very exciting. You know, radio was still involved.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
MTV was still involved, mm-hmm. you know, all that stuff. And you really had, when you made your product, it was yours to sell. And as you know, that has all changed now.
Well, and also I'll say this as a collector and someone who's enjoyed buying music, putting my money down and actually being handed a physical thing back to me for my money still really matters. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of digital money going out and digital music coming in or digital movies coming in, I'm still having a hard time as an old man getting my head around that there's value in ones and zeros sitting on a hard drive.
Exactly.
That's a weird thing for me because I want to be able to hold a CD or a record and smell the vinyl or look at the album lyrics or whatever. And that's a hard thing.
Right, while you're listening.
Yeah, that's something as an old man I still greatly miss.
Right. And that's why I appreciate, and you do as well, that we grew up being able to experience that time because there's a whole other generation has never had that experience.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I love also about working with Yes, is these are like-minded guys who have been at this since the 60s,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we release a live record every year, and it's also always on vinyl
mm-hmm.
every year. And the fans that we have are like-minded like you, and they love the vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
They always pre-order the vinyl. Plus, you know, they got the CDs to bang around in the car, but they always order the vinyl. So Roger Dean's artwork is on full, you know, display. You can really, just like the old days, have your headphones on, be playing a live show, and be looking at gorgeous live pictures, gorgeous Roger Dean artwork, you know, and you can experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole thing. Yeah.
One of my favorite vinyl memories actually involves a Yes song and how a CD screwed it up for me. When I was growing up, my parents had a Roundabout on vinyl and there was a scratch in it. And every time I hit the organ solo, there was this bump and a scratch and it kind of this very distinct record moving across a bunch of grooves line, a noise. And the organ solo, that's what it was. That's what my memory had the organ solo as. Fast forward to when I got to college, I buy it on CD, get the organ solo, and it's not there. And it actually made me kind of angry that it was the full solo and not my memory of the record bouncing across the grooves. And
that's
hilarious. And I am so sad that my parents don't have that album anymore because that was the organic knowledge I had of that song was that scratch, that affected record. And now that it's clean and pretty and digital and unaffected and everywhere, there's a part of me that kind of misses that natural thing that happened.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I love the sound of a needle dropping on a record.
Mm-hmm.
Just the thunk.
Yep.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yep.
Yeah, I still have lots of vinyl and an old school stereo system with my JBLs, you know, and the mm-hmm. whole thing. And there's just nothing like it. Go back and listen to, you know, a Mahavishnu Orchestra record with the thunk of the needle mm-hmm. through JBLs. I mean, poof, there you go. But again, that's just showing our wisdom.
I was going to say age, but wisdom is, I like wisdom better. It's less judgy.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I need to ask you about the band Conspiracy, because I really liked them and I wish they had done more. Tell me a little bit about how you got involved with them and how it all kind of played out.
Well, let's see. I guess it's so much of my Yes world has centered around, you know, two people, Tony Kaye and Billy Sherwood. So Billy had joined Yes in that period that I was talking about, the Talk record, et cetera, you know, that era, the latter. Tony was in the band too, as well. And Tony had done 90125 when we were in Badfinger, and I was off playing with Danny Johnson and the Bandits opening for ZZ Top. So there was always this, you know, center of connection. So Billy was pretty much the center. So we would be doing his solo record. And we did The Big Piece. We did several others. And Chris and he had been collaborating. And he asked me to play on some of the music. So we did on the first record, Say Goodbye, and a couple of other ones, Man in the Moon, I think. And then when The Unknown came around, of course, that was a more concentrated effort of all new music. And we got together and we just had a ball doing that one, I'll tell you. That was a crazy time, too, because that was 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course, some of the emotion and lyrics, you know, reflect that, you know. So it was pretty crazy. But that's when I first began working with Chris and getting to know what that was all about. Because I had met these guys over and over again during the Badfinger years, you know, for Hollywood Bowl parties at Tony Kaye's house, and you know, Alan and Trevor and Chris would all be there, and so it was always that kind of a thing. And playing the central was also kind of that's basically what the Viper Room is, you know, now. But it used to be a club that was run by two English roadies. And Badfinger, we played there to open that club. It's probably late 81, early 82. And everybody would come in there to jam. From the Roxy, John Mayall was in there all the time, Robin Ford. Dudley Moore was hanging out all the time. Dee Murray, Davy Johnston from Elton John's band. And Mark Craney was coming in. And it was just an amazing melting pot of just, you know, musical energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so basically that's kind of how it happened. Is it was Billy, Chris, and I just kind of knocking stuff out. And Billy's production.
Expecting you never to tell when you might be next one.
I thoroughly enjoy both of those albums, and I know that everyone moved on to other things, but those are two albums that I still kind of hang on to and drop in on occasion because I really do enjoy them.
Yeah, we wanted to do more with it. We did. And we did the live video for Conspiracy. But Chris was rejoining Yes. Well, I don't mean rejoining. They were beginning a new tour cycle. So he had a lot of work to do. And so Conspiracy was always a side project, and it involved Chris. So it all depended on how Chris's, you know, had time or, you know, effort to be involved. So,
well, Jay,
as I'm sure glad we did it.
Yeah. As we start to wrap up, tell people what you're up to now, where they can find you, follow you, reach out to you if they want to, all that kind of stuff.
Sure. Well, where I'm at right now is working on the new live stage production for the new Yes tour coming up, which we will be covering the cruise, of course, the cruise to the edge, and then an extensive tour of Europe, and then a couple weeks off, and then a very extensive tour of the U.S. So it's going to be a longer touring cycle than we usually do. So we're looking forward to that. But the main centerpiece is we're going to be performing Relayer in its entirety.
Oh, wow.
That hasn't been performed in 45 years.
Wow.
Last year, we introduced Gates of Delirium in its entirety for the Royal Affair tour. And it was just mega cool. And so I think that gave everyone the confidence. Let's go ahead and do the entire record. It has not been done in 45 years. So that's the centerpiece. And I think it's really exciting for everybody. And certainly for us. So we're in the middle of working on the production of the new stage look. And then we'll begin our rehearsals in March. And aside from that, I've recorded some records for some great guitarists in Japan. And it features Paul Shortino as well as the solo singer. And so I do drum tracks constantly. And if people are looking for some drums, they can get a hold of me through jshellen.com. And when I'm able, which is pretty often, I do have a drum studio and I can lay down tracks for folks. And I also have a book that's published called Rocking Independence. And my publisher is currently printing up the second edition. We sold out of the first edition. And that's also a interesting introduction to four limb coordination and the left foot rocking motion that we were speaking about. Yeah. So I stay busy.
It sounds for sure. It sure sounds like it.
Yeah, and I also still play in Vegas with Raiding the Rock Vault, which, if folks haven't heard of it, it's an all-star Hall of Fame, you know, platinum gold artist group.
Where does that play?
Well, it just moved again. We started at the LVH, which is the old Hilton where Elvis, you know, did all his. It was called the International back in the Rat Pack days. And then we moved to the Tropicana. And then we moved to the Hard Rock. And that now has been sold to Richard Branson. So it's going to, they're actually doing construction on it right now. And so now the show's moved to the Rio.
Okay.
Yeah. So it gets around, you know, but it's got, you know, you know, the biggest guys you could think of, Howard Leese, Hugh McDonald's on bass from Bon Jovi, Doug Aldrich plays guitar, Tracy Guns has been in it, Rowan Robertson from Dio, Paul Shortino from Rough Cut, there's Robin McCauley from Michael Schenker, McCauley Schenker, and Survivor, and it just keeps going.
That's very cool. I'm going to have, next time I'm in Vegas, I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah. Everybody loves it. It's a fun show. It's been 6 years now going on. We hold a lot of records in Vegas. Some of them dubious, but all good.
Well, Jay, I really appreciate you taking time in your schedule and your day to chat with me. And this has been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed this.
Yeah, great. Me too. Me too. And I really hope that everybody can keep a lookout for the 2020 Yes tour that's coming up, featuring Relayer and all the great hits that everybody loves. And we'll be in the U.S. In the fall. So I hope people come out and see it.
For more Beyond the Playlist with Jay Hammond C, you can go to jhammondc.com. You can follow me on Twitter at jhammondc. You can email the show at jhammondc@gmail.com. The theme music is by Magnus Ellegren, featuring Jimmy C and the New York Brass. The cover art is by Phil Rude. You can join the Facebook group for Beyond the Playlist with Jay Hammond C. You can find this and other fine shows streaming at Alpha Geek Radio. If you like what you hear, you can go to iTunes or Stitcher and leave a review. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Playlist with Jay Hammond C.
Chased amid fusions of wonder, in moments hardly seen forgotten, colored in pastures of chance, dancing leaves cast spells of challenge, amused but reeling thoughts. We fled from the sea. Oh. Transferred through moments of days and the searching of revealing quarters of time, provoking memories disjointed but with purpose, craving penetrations of the links with the self-instructor's sharp and tender love as we took to the air a picture of distance. Dawn of our poem is redescending as fast as misused expression, as only to teach my past to the depression, chasing light to the corners, and we dance from the ocean. Dawn of love set within us, colors of awakening among the many want to follow. Forget what happened.
about the story. Move over, glory to songs of all fighters past. Young Christians see it from the beginning. Old people feel it. That's what they're saying. Move over. We'll be right back. souls to follow and show all we feel for and love. Castro, you seekers of the truth, accepting that reasons will relive and breathe and hope and chase.